Tudors were voracious builders. King Henry VIII built at least 60 palaces, castles or grand houses during his long reign, as did his daughter, Queen Elizabeth I. Six of the royal palaces were large enough to comfortably house the entire court, which at key points of the year, such as Christmas, could be as many as 1,500 people. These six properties were Richmond Palace, Hampton Court Palace, the Palace of Placentia, aka Greenwich Palace, Eltham, Woodstock, and the Palace of Beaulieu. There was also the gargantuan palace or complex known as Whitehall, right in the heart of London, which until Versailles came along in the 17th century, was the largest palace in Europe, even bigger than the Vatican, with more than 1,500 rooms. And then there was the magnificent and entirely lost Nonsuch Palace, so named, for it was so grand that there had been none such like it. Finally, there was the great fortress of the Tower of London, the most potent and oldest symbol of royal authority visible in Great Britain. And yet much of what the Tudors would have recognised is now entirely lost. In fact, of all of these properties, only Hampton Court, the Tower of London and Eltham remain, and at each, huge parts of the original Tudor buildings no longer exist. So what were these lost properties? What went on in them? And why, oh why, do they no longer exist? Welcome back to the Tudor Chess Podcast, episode 31, Tudor England's Lost Palaces. I grew up in the southeast of England, right on the border between London and the neighbouring county of Surrey. My childhood home practically overlooked the original location of one of Tudor England's greatest palaces, Nonsuch, for which sadly absolutely nothing remains, and is now simply a gorgeous park with a lovely, albeit 18th century, mansion house at its centre. Nonsuch, like many other major Tudor palaces, fell into disrepair and were torn down by either the late Stuarts or the Georgians. And I'm saying it now, but the Stuarts and Georgians will come up quite a lot in this episode because they have a lot to answer for when it comes to destroying once great Tudor palaces, castles, and homes. Perhaps the greatest loss to fans of Tudor England is the Palace of Whitehall, simply because, firstly, it was just so colossal, but also because of the incredible history which took place within its walls. Whitehall was not the palace's initial name, nor was it originally built for royalty. The place first crops up in 1240, with Walter de Grey, the Archbishop of York, needing a London residence and bought a large house, which he then called York Place. The property was further expanded by King Edward I, but took on its truly mammoth scale during the 15th century, when a certain Cardinal Thomas Wolsey took over. He expanded it so significantly that soon it was rivalled only by Lambeth Palace as the greatest house in the capital. Following Wolsey's fall from favour in 1530, King Henry VIII took over York Place and decided to make it his primary London residence. He actually inspected the property alongside Anne Boleyn, and in 1532, the name of Whitehall was first recorded. It is believed that Henry landed on the name for the white stone that was used in the design of the property. He went literal, basically. Magnificent and fully privatised gardens were added to the west of the main complex, and taking inspiration from his downriver property at Richmond, and being a fan of sport, the king added several sporting facilities, including an indoor tennis court, a cockfighting pit, and a bowling green, as well as a spectacular tilt yard for the ever-popular sport of jousting. The building work conducted by the king was a joint project between Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn, who had planned for the palace to be their future marital home. Indeed, it was the location of their wedding at the start of 1533. The marriage was famously small and intimate, taking place in one of the upper chambers of the Holbein Gate within Whitehall. The palace was also the location for Anne's coronation feasts and jousts, which were held at the palace in May and early June of that same year, by which point serious building work had commenced on the site. Interestingly, architectural historian and the former chief executive of English Heritage, Simon Thurley, noted in his work of Tudor palaces and in particular Whitehall, that Anne Boleyn was almost certainly the only wife of King Henry VIII's who showed an open interest and passion in architecture. This is evidenced from the fact that building plans for Whitehall were sent to both Henry and Anne for approval, and furthermore, Henry allowed Anne significant say in the planned decorations. Perhaps the king's confidence in Anne was as a result of her famously exquisite taste. This may also account for the clear bug for palace building that Elizabeth I inherited. If such a passion was seen in both her parents, it was almost inevitable. Unfortunately for Anne Boleyn, however, she did not live long enough to see the building work completed. By the end of 1536, an Act of Parliament gave the palace the official status as the king's chief residence, with in excess of 1,500 rooms and a mind-boggling 3 million square foot in footprint. It truly was a royal mega-complex. In fact, it was more like the size of a small town sat right in the centre of London. Anne Boleyn would not be the only one of Henry VIII's wives who the king married at Whitehall. For her direct successor, Jane Seymour married the king in the palace on the 30th of May, 1536, just 11 days after the execution of her former mistress. Famously, the palace was also the place where the king himself died. He had been ill for some time, eventually lost the power of speech, and breathed his last in the early hours of the 28th of January, 1547. He was aged 55 years old. His entrails were buried in Whitehall's Chapel Royal, and his body lay in state in the Privy Chamber, which incidentally was the same room in which the famous Whitehall mural by Hans Holbein, that huge life-size canvas of Henry VIII and Jane Seymour on the king's parents, Henry VIII and Elizabeth of York, was hung. The king's final resting place would be St George's Chapel in Windsor. Despite the tyranny of his reign, the king was greatly mourned, and as his successor was a boy of just 9, there was great fear that the country would slide back into the anarchies of the Wars of the Roses. Queen Elizabeth I stayed at Whitehall more than any other palace in England. Its colossal scale made housing the entire court easier, and also had the added benefit of being so close to the Palace of Westminster, where Parliament and the Law Courts sat. The Queen spent many Christmases at Whitehall Palace. One memorable festive season came in 1581, when negotiations between England and France were taking place, hoping to see the Queen marry Francis, Duke of Alençon. Due to the increased number of guests, and foreign ones at that, the Queen wanted to put on a good display and added a banqueting house onto the palace as a means of conveying the further brilliance of her court. This banqueting house was only meant to be temporary, but remained in use until the reign of King James I. Whitehall was also the setting for the very first performance of what is generally accepted to be William Shakespeare's final play, The Tempest, which took place in 1611. The early Stuart kings would also treat Whitehall as their primary London base. Indeed, it would be used for an altogether darker and shocking scene when King Charles I was executed at the palace. He was beheaded on a raised platform erected directly in front of the redesigned banqueting house created by his father, King James I. Despite it being the scene of his father's death, when King Charles II returned to England and re-established the monarchy, he would spend a lot of time at Whitehall, making extensive renovation works across the whole complex. The problem that Whitehall ultimately faced, though, was that it had become, in effect, a complete mess. It lacked any uniformity in design, and its layout was insanely scattered. It was, in effect, a mongrel of a palace, a patchwork of various designs and purposes and layouts. It majorly lacked cohesion, made all the worse by the fact that courtiers would regularly extend their own small corners of the palace. A notable example here was Stephen Fox, a clerk in the employ of Charles II, who had been given a rather modest 3 rooms, but he eventually constructed a grand mansion with all of the mod cons, a coach house and stables, all within the palace network itself. The place must have been a complete nightmare to get around. This was, after all, in the days before Google Maps. By the end of the 17th century, the palace was the largest and frankly most convoluted building in Europe. Much of the older palace structure was damaged in a fire which broke out in April 1691, although the state apartments remained unharmed. Ironically, the fire actually removed a lot of the complexities of the complex, leaving behind a clearer and more unified footprint. 7 years later, however, a second fire broke out and destroyed much of what remained. the great banqueting house, the jewel in the crown of Whitehall, is all that survived the fire that can still be seen to this day. A few other bits here and there are still in existence, but used for very different purposes. For example, one of the covered tennis courts that was installed by Henry VIII is now a cabinet office. Henry VIII's wine cellar is another survivor, but sadly, as it sits in the basement of the Ministry of Defence, access to the cellar is understandably incredibly limited. So what of the most famous of Henry VIII's palaces, Hampton Court? Hampton Court is, alongside the Tower of London, one of the great survivors of the Tudor age. With that said, huge portions of the original Tudor building were torn down by those pesky Georgians, and so the palace today is very much a tale of two stories, with the older Tudor palace at the front and the Palladian Georgian at the back. The site of Hampton Court Palace was originally in the ownership of the Order of St John of Jerusalem, but was taken over by Thomas Wolsey, then Archbishop of York, in 1514. He was made a cardinal in the following year. From 1514 to 1521, Wolsey spent lavishly 200,000 crowns, or, by my reckoning, roughly £34 million by modern standards, to build the finest palace in England at the time. Sadly, little of Thomas Wolsey's building work remains completely unchanged. The first courtyard, known as the Base Court, was his creation, as was the second, known as the Inner Gatehouse, which leads to the Clock Court, from where Wolsey's seal remains visible over the entrance arch of the clock tower. At the time, these then led to his private rooms. The Base Court contained 44 lodgings reserved for guests, while the Clock Court contained the very best rooms, the state apartments, reserved for the king and his family. Immediately after the state apartments were finished in 1525, the king came for the first of many visits. In building his palace, Wolsey was attempting to recreate the classical Renaissance cardinals' palaces that were seen in Europe. The architectural historian, Sir John Summerson, asserts that the palace shows the essence of Wolsey, the plain English churchman who nevertheless made his sovereign the arbiter of Europe, and who built and furnished Hampton Court to show foreign embassies that Henry VIII's chief minister knew how to live as graciously as any cardinal in Rome. Whatever the concepts were, the architecture is an excellent and rare example of a 30-year era when English architecture was in a harmonious transition from domestic Tudor, strongly influenced by the Perpendicular Gothic, to the Italian Renaissance classical style, which would become a staple of future Tudor building creations. Sadly for Wolsey, he was only able to enjoy the palace for a few years, for in 1529, knowing that his enemies and the king were engineering his downfall, he passed the palace to the king as a wise gift. It did not help, and he died a few months later en route to the capital to stand trial for treason. Almost as soon as the keys were in his hand, King Henry VIII began his own modifications and naturally expansions. The king liked to entertain, and few of his properties were large enough to hold the entire assembled court. In taking over Hampton Court, he thus set about making it large enough, both in terms of scale, but also in resources, to comfortably house the entire Tudor entourage. One of the key parts in achieving this was the creation of vast kitchens, needed to churn out the constant demand for the finest meats, pastries, bread, alcohol, and so on. The kitchens were quadrupled in size in 1529, enabling the king to provide what is known as bouche of court, which was basically free food and drink for the entire court. Think of it a bit like the Tudor equivalent of an on-site canteen for workers at somewhere like Google. In architecture, the king followed the design precedent set by Wolsey, perpendicular, Gothic-inspired Tudor with restrained Renaissance ornaments. This hybrid architecture was to remain almost unchanged for nearly a century until Inigo Jones introduced strong classical influences from Italy to the London palaces of the first Stuart kings. Between 1532 and 1535, Henry VIII added the Great Hall and the Royal Tennis Court, both of which survive to this day. The Great Hall has a carved hammer beam roof. During Tudor times, this was the most important room of the palace. Here, the king would dine in state, seated at a table on a raised dais. The hall took 5 years to complete, with workers quite literally working all of the hours that God sent, for the king was so impatient for its completion that builders were compelled to work throughout the night by candlelight. The gatehouse to the second inner courtyard was adorned in 1540 with the Hampton Court astronomical clock, which also survives to this day. It also still functions. The clock shows the time of the day, the phases of the moon, the month, the quarter of the year, the date, the sun and the star sign, and most astonishingly of all, the water levels at London Bridge. This last piece of information the clock would provide was of great importance to those visiting the Thameside Palace from London, as the preferred method of transport at the time was by barge, and at low water, London Bridge created dangerous rapids. The clock therefore enabled visitors to basically go, oh shit, the water's low, we best dash. This gatehouse is now known as Anne Boleyn's Gate, the name being a much later addition, for work was still underway on Anne Boleyn's apartments above the gate when the Queen was beheaded. Anne Boleyn has herself become synonymous with the palace. One of the greatest joys of the Great Hall is the small touches created to honour Anne Boleyn that can still be seen to this day, despite Henry VIII's attempts to remove any remnants of her from the palace following Anne Boleyn's execution. As you enter the Great Hall, on either side there is a magnificent wooden screen with various very detailed carvings. If you look closely, and palace stewards will also help point them out, two intertwined H&As can still be seen, overlooked by the carpenters tasked with removing any trace of Anne from the palace. During the Tudor period, the palace was the scene of many historic events. In 1537, the king's much-desired male heir, the future Edward VI, was born at the palace and was also the site of the child's mother, Jane Seymour's, death 2 weeks later. The apartments in which Jane gave birth also remain to this day. However, they are closed off to the public and are now whitewashed office rooms. Pre-pandemic, there was a plan in place to restore these rooms and bring them back to the original Tudor style, although sadly, that project has been put on pause for the time being. Another supposedly dramatic moment at the palace took place in 1541. Henry VIII was attending mass in the palace's chapel from where he was informed of the adultery of his fifth queen, Catherine Howard. Catherine was confined to her rooms for a few days before being sent to Sion House and then onto the Tower of London to await her execution. Legend claims that she briefly escaped her guards while staying at Hampton Court Palace and ran through the processional route, now known as the Haunted Gallery, to beg Henry VIII for her life before being recaptured. Catherine's ghost is even said to haunt the gallery, hence the modern nickname. And furthermore, her ghost is said to only be from the knees up, for the floor has been raised a couple of feet since Catherine's lifetime. King Henry VIII died in January 1547 and was succeeded by his son Edward VI and then by both his daughters in turn. It was to Hampton Court that Queen Mary I retreated with her husband, Philip of Spain, to spend their honeymoon after their wedding at Winchester Cathedral. Mary chose Hampton Court as the place for the birth of her first child, which famously turned out to be the first of two phantom pregnancies, also known as pseudocyesis. Mary stayed at the palace awaiting the birth of her child for over 5 months and only left because of the uninhabitable state of the palace, with the court being kept in the same location for so long. Mary's court departed for the much smaller palace of Oatlands nearby. Mary was then succeeded by her half-sister, Elizabeth I, and it was Elizabeth who had the Eastern Kitchen built. For those who've been to the palace in the modern era, it's now where the palace's tea rooms are. After the death of the Tudor dynasty, the crown passed into their successors, the Stuarts. The first Stuart kings, James I and Charles I, made use of the palace but did not alter or renovate it. During the interregnum following Charles I's execution, the palace was largely unscathed, at least compared to other royal palaces which were either completely destroyed or badly damaged. The palace was, nonetheless, still subject to the passages of time and the evolutions of taste, and so by the time of the monarchy's restoration and the next Stuart kings, Charles II and his successor, James II, it was beginning to appear old-fashioned. Everyone in Europe was going gaga for Versailles, the palatial and frankly ludicrous palace which was the home of the French monarchy. And so efforts were made to bring some of the Versailles sparkle into England by rebuilding royal palaces in the overtly opulent Baroque style so associated with this period. Now, those no good bastards, William III and Mary II, are to blame for the loss of much of the Tudor palace to be replaced with the Baroque that we see today. Within months of their accession, they embarked on a massive rebuilding project of Hampton Court, with the intention to demolish the Tudor palace one section at a time, while replacing it with a huge modern palace in the Baroque style. Their original intention was to retain only Henry VIII's Great Hall, and so I suppose we should be semi-grateful that they did not go the whole hog, as it were, and left what we still see to this day. Even so, the final work carried out by the country's preeminent architect, Sir Christopher Wren, did result in over half of the Tudor palace being replaced, with Henry VIII's staterooms and private apartments lost to us. Yes, I know, absolutely fuming. Hampton Court now stands as one of England's greatest and most important stately homes, and can be visited throughout the year. Given where I grew up, it was always easy to get to, and so I must have visited the palace at least 30 times. Each time I go, I always spot something new. I just wish that the lost parts still existed. The last time I was at the palace was actually as part of a sort of merry band of other historians, including Sandra Vizzoli, Sarah Morris, Owen Emerson, Natalie Gruniger, and I suggested that historic royal palaces should try to create a digital recreation of the lost palace, which perhaps I'll just do myself. I think it needs to be done. That leads me nicely into Nonsuch Palace, which was built semi with Hampton Court in mind, and was considered to be the most beautiful of the properties built during the Tudor reign. It was commissioned by Henry VIII, but was not completed by the time of his death. The property stood among acres and acres of beautiful countryside in Surrey, a county in the southeast of England, directly south of London. The parkland around it, Nonsuch Park, remains and sits on the boundaries of the boroughs of Epsom and Newell in Surrey and Cheam within the London borough of Sutton, which is where I now live. Nonsuch Palace was Henry VIII's chance to show off. The palace was designed to be a celebration of the power and the grandeur of the Tudor dynasty, built specifically to rival King Francis I's Chateau de Chambord. It was, forgive me, something of a who's got the bigger dick project. Unlike most of Henry VIII's palaces, Nonsuch was not an adaptation of an old building. This wasn't Henry being given the keys by the former resident of a palace that he had decided to take over. Instead, Nonsuch was entirely his own creation. He found the land and chose to build a new palace based entirely around his own image and desires. It is generally accepted that the choice of location came down to the fact that it was so close to one of his main hunting grounds. The palace was built on the site of Cuddington, near Ewell, with both the church and the original Ewell village both being destroyed to create a suitable site for the palace and its grounds to be set up. Thankfully, those whose houses were destroyed were compensated heavily for their loss, which is something, I guess. Work began on the 22nd of April 1538, the first day of Henry VIII's 30th regnal year, and 6 months after the birth of his long-fought son, Prince Edward. Although entirely new in its creation, the palace did nonetheless follow the conventions of the time, that is to say that it was rectangular with a completely hollow centre, save for a below-stairs cellar at its centre. The rooms were arranged in what is known in architecture speak as enfilade, with each room in a row leading from one to the other, rather than there being a central hallway and corridors leading to other rooms in the way that most houses are built today. In selecting the designers of his palace, Henry VIII turned to the tried, tested and trusted figures of Christopher Dickinson and William Clement, who had been the architects and builders of Hampton Court Palace. Despite its ostentation, Nonsuch was far smaller than Hampton Court, perhaps only a third of the size, but was nonetheless designed with the bigger palace in mind. Just as at Hampton Court, there were two gatehouses, the first a broader one leading into the outer court, and a taller narrow one to the inner. In keeping with Hampton Court, to the north of the palace were the kitchens. Nonsuch was by no means a copy of Hampton Court, though. Several facets of its design were new to England. What distinguished Nonsuch from traditional architecture, perhaps the most, were stunning stucco panels in between the timber framing of the palace's facade by the Italian artificier Nicholas Bellin of Modena. Bellin's was already famous across Europe for his work on the Fontainebleau for Francis I of France, but claimed asylum in England after allegations of fraud were levied against him by Francis I of France. Now, with this in mind, I suspect that Henry VIII got something of a kick out of hiring someone that his greatest rival had once employed with the basis of his role to make the palace all the grander. At a cost of £25,000 or over £10 million by modern standards, how on earth was Nonsuch Palace paid for? Well, for that, we need only look to the dissolution of the monasteries. In fact, Nonsuch Palace was literally built on top of the remains of Merton Abbey. Over 3,600 loads of chalk and stone were delivered to the site and formed foundations and the core of the masonry walls. The outer courtyard and its gatehouse were faced in stone. But the important part of the palace, the inner court, the part where the royal lodgings were, was timber framed. It has been suggested that Nonsuch was probably the largest timber framed structure ever to be erected in England. It must have also been a complete feast for the eyes, with the black and white Tudor panelling adorning much of the palace's facade. Henry VIII would never see the palace in its finished state, for work was still taking place when he died in January 1547. As best we can tell, Nonsuch was only ever visited by the king on three occasions, making it something of an extremely expensive white elephant, for this last great passion of Henry VIII's was, in many respects, symbolic of a man who had always striven to exude such grandeur, but in the end was unable to live long enough to see the plans of his sumptuous palace come to fruition. In 1556, Queen Mary I sold it to Henry FitzAlan, the 19th Earl of Arundel, who completed the palace. In 1585, the Treaty of Nonsuch, as it became known, was signed by Elizabeth I and the Dutch Republic at the palace. It was then returned into royal hands in the 1590s. Nonsuch came to Anne of Denmark as her jointure property as the consort of King James I of England and 6th of Scotland. The Great Park remained the property of Lord Lumley until he surrendered the lease to the Queen in 1605. With that said, Queen Anne rarely visited, although both her husband James and their son, the future King Charles I, regularly visited for hunting and racing. Following Parliament's victory in the English Civil War, the Nonsuch estate was confiscated and let to a series of parliamentarian supporters. The palace was handed back to the Crown after the Restoration in 1660, with the palace given to Queen Henrietta Maria. Nonsuch remained royal property until 1670, when Charles II gave it to his mistress, the notorious Barbara, Countess of Castlemaine, with the title of Baroness of Nonsuch. Infuriatingly, she had it pulled down around 1682 and sold off the building materials to pay gambling debts. She is one of those bloody Georgians I mentioned earlier who have a huge amount to answer for. Did she have no care for posterity? Although the palace is, itself, completely lost, some elements or features of it were incorporated into other buildings. For example, some of the wood panelling can still be seen today in the Great Hall at Loseley Park near Guildford in Surrey. No traces of the palace remain on its site today though, but some pieces are held in the British Museum. There is also a discernible rise of land where the old Cuddington Church used to be before it was demolished to make way for the palace. The site is now, as I referenced earlier, simply a park, albeit a very beautiful one, which incidentally played a huge part in my life and is my favourite place on earth. Nonsuch Park is where I learned to ride a bike, it's where we took our dogs for walks, it's where I go running in the summer, I even have the park's coordinates tattooed on the back of my left arm. The park is also the home of Nonsuch Girls' School, a very good grammar school which amongst its alumni includes the incredible historian Professor Susanna Lipscomb. From the far south of London, I'm now going to head east to discuss another entirely lost palace, the Palace of Placentia, more commonly known as Greenwich Palace. The palace was initially built by Humphrey, Duke of Gloucester, in 1443 and named Bela Court. The Duke was a younger brother of King Henry V and as such was uncle to the infant King Henry VI. In 1447, Humphrey fell out of favour with Henry VI, who had now reached adulthood, and was arrested for high treason. He died in prison, likely due to a stroke, although persistent rumours of murder still abound. Henry VI's wife, the controversial but fascinating Margaret of Anjou, took over Bela Court and rechristened it the Palace of Placentia. By the time of the Tudors and Henry VII's reign, the palace was in dire need of repair, and so the decision was taken to simply rebuild the palace entirely, which took place between 1498 and 1504, with a design based around three large courtyards. Although the structure is no longer standing, the size and design of Greenwich Palace was said to be similar to that of Hampton Court Palace, which was built around the same time as Henry VII rebuilt Placentia. The original building was constructed primarily with brick and timber. It had state apartments, a chapel, a five-storey viewing tower, and two octagonal towers overlooking the tiltyard. The chapel was rebuilt by Henry VIII, featured stained glass windows and black and white glazed tiles. The main face of the building looked out over the River Thames. It extended along a 200-metre stretch of the bank of the river and was accessible by boat. Piles from the original Tudor-era jetty remain there to this day, a rare survivor. Its red brick exterior was a deliberate choice, for it showcased the English king's wealth, as the material was expensive to manufacture and considered an extravagance. Aside from the chapel renovations, Henry VIII also added an armory, stables, and a banquet hall to the original palace. It would then remain as a primary royal residence for the next two centuries. The Palace of Placentia played a major role in the life of King Henry VIII, for firstly, he was born there in 1491, and it was also the location of his daughter Princess Mary's birth in 1516 and the birth of Princess Elizabeth in September 1533. Henry also chose Placentia as the location for his short-lived marriage to Anne of Cleves, which took place in January 1540. Both Mary I and Elizabeth I lived at Placentia for some years during the 16th century, but by the Civil War, the palace had fallen into major neglect, even serving for a time as a biscuit factory and as a prisoner of war camp. In 1660, Charles II decided to rebuild the palace, engaging John Webb as the architect for the new King's House. The only section of the new building to be completed was the east range of the present King Charles's court, but this was never occupied as a royal residence. Most of the rest of the palace was demolished, and the site remained empty until the construction of Greenwich Hospital began in 1694. During the early 17th century, as the palace was being rebuilt, Queen Anne of Denmark commissioned several buildings, including the Queen's House, three rooms along the garden, and a grotto aviary to be built in the gardens. The only surviving building of the 17th century additions to the palace is the Queen's House. This building, designed by architect Inigo Jones, is of particular architectural and historical significance, as it is often credited as being the first classical building in England and was a clear departure from Tudor style. The Greenwich Hospital complex became the Royal Navy College in 1873 and is now occupied by the University of Greenwich. Not a single aspect of the core Tudor palace remains. And so finally, we have the great fortress, the Tower of London. The name of the Tower of London is in fact just a shortened version of its full title, which is His Majesty's Royal Palace and Fortress of the Tower of London. No building in the UK has as much royal history woven into its DNA as the Tower of London, although Westminster Abbey comes a very, very close second. The Tower of London's history is vast. It dates back to the time of William the Conqueror, and so I won't go into all of the details now, otherwise we'd have a 3-hour podcast on our hands. Instead, I will focus on the main aspects of the fortress and highlight which parts are sadly lost, of which there are very many. At one time, the Tower of London was almost like a town within London itself, making it somewhat comparable to Whitehall, although more contained given that the tower had clear outer walls. To demonstrate just how much of a small town the place was, during the early period of the Tudors, it had as many as 15 pubs within its walls alone. Yes, you heard that right, 15 pubs. I'm surprised the guards were able to get anything done and that more prisoners didn't escape. I mean, the air alone must have been 15% proof. The Tower of London is perhaps most famous for two key aspects of its story. Firstly, that it was the place of some of the most famous executions in British history, including two of King Henry VIII's wives, Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard. And secondly, that it is the home of the crown jewels, these being the crowns, sceptre, orbs and other priceless artefacts which are central to both the monarchy and the act of coronation. The crown jewels are still held within the tower to this day and are one of the biggest draws to the site for overseas tourists. Sadly, what visitors to the Tower of London now see is but a fraction of the once colossal site. Certainly 14 of those 15 pubs are now long gone, although one does still remain for the use of those who work at the tower and also call the place home. And that's actually one of the other remarkable aspects of the fortress. The yeoman warders, more commonly known as beefeaters, and their families, the sitting tower governor, and a garrison of soldiers all still call the palace their home. There's even an on-site doctor and a chaplain based out of the chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula, the small church inside the tower's walls, which is the final resting place of many of its most famous victims. At the centre of the Tower of London complex is the White Tower, which is also the oldest part. As the name would suggest, it's a great white keep, which contained various prison cells and the royal armoury. The White Tower has not changed since the time of the Tudors and appears today as Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn would have known it. There are then two walls surrounding the tower, the famous Traitor's Gate, which was the entrance through which prisoners would enter the tower, although not Anne Boleyn, a common misconception, who entered via the private Byward Tower door. There are also several other parts of the tower that the Tudors would recognise, including the Queen's House, not to be confused with the Queen's Apartments, more on that later, and then the aforementioned Chapel of St. Peter at Vincula. The huge Waterloo block, which sits to the north of the White Tower, is a relatively new addition, being built in 1845, and is thus not somewhere the Tudors would recognise. The Waterloo block is now the home of the Crown Jewels. During the Tudor period, there were many more significant buildings within the tower complex, with the vast majority of these to the south and southeast of the White Tower, on what is now a large expanse of grass known as the Innermost Ward. There have been royal apartments on the site of the Tower of London as far back as the early 13th century, when during the reign of King Henry II, a permanent inner ward was created and separate lodgings for both the king and the queen were constructed. One of the biggest parts of the old tower that is now completely lost to us is the Great Hall. The entrance to the inner ward was through the also now lost Cold Harbour Gate, although there are some small remnants of that gate that could still be seen to the southwest of the White Tower today. Unlike the Great Hall of Hampton Court Palace, which faces north to south, the tower's Great Wall faced east to west, occupying the southernmost aspect of the inner ward. To the right of the Great Hall were a series of other buildings, including the one-time magnificent royal apartments. At the turn of the 16th century, King Henry VII had significantly extended the king's lodgings, including the addition of a new tower and a suite of rooms for his mother, Lady Margaret Beaufort. In 1532, Henry VIII ordered his chief minister, Thomas Cromwell, to organise the refurbishment of the royal apartments on both the king and queen's sides in anticipation of the planned coronation of the king's second wife, Anne Boleyn. The large queen's watching chamber, which was actually twice the size of the king's, was relatively simply refurbished, but all of the other rooms would undergo a full refit at a cost of roughly £2 million by modern standards. These Renaissance-style apartments were therefore the height of luxury, but would take on a different role for Anne Boleyn just 3 years later. Following her arrest on trumped-up charges of adultery and high treason, Anne was taken as a prisoner to the Tower of London to await her trial and eventual execution. She did not, however, have to go into a dungeon, but was instead lodged in the Queen's apartments. This was the great irony of Anne's time spent in the Tower, for the location of her greatest high, the zenith of her rise to power, the place where she stayed on the eve of her coronation, was now the same place in which her greatest fall would unfold. Infuriatingly, if you go to the Tower of London today, it is not possible to see Anne's apartments and later prison, because these lodgings were uninhabitable by the end of the 16th century and completely demolished by the end of the 18th century. Why, oh why, couldn't they have taken steps to protect them? Did they not realise that 200 years later, millions of people from across the world would be desperate to see them? Clearly not. They're fools. To get back to an earlier point, the classically black and white half-timbered building known as the Queen's House, which overlooks Tower Green, is not the same place as the Queen's apartments. It is not where Anne was imprisoned, as these apartments were actually built 4 years after her death. The location of the famous executioner's scaffold is another subject about which there is some confusion, mostly caused by the small glass memorial set up on Tower Green, which states that this was the spot on which Anne Boleyn, Catherine Howard, Lady Jane Grey, and so on were executed. Now, sorry to burst bubbles for those who've been there, taken pictures, and gone, wow, I'm on the spot where Anne Boleyn died. That's actually completely inaccurate. The actual location of where the executioner's scaffold was has been convincingly proven as being in front of what is now the entrance to the Crown Jewels within the Waterloo block. And so whilst the monument on Tower Green is lovely, it isn't an accurate representation of where the scaffold stood. And so what route would the tower's most famous victim, Anne Boleyn, have taken on the morning of the 19th of May 1536? To truly understand this, I recommend looking up an old visual of the tower, as it appeared then. You can find these online just by Googling it, but I will try and paint the picture for you nonetheless. Anne would have been visited in the Queen's apartments, and bear in mind they are to the southeast of the White Tower, and told that the time of her death had arrived. She would have left the Queen's apartments and walked across the inner ward diagonally towards the Cold Harbour Gate. She would have passed under the gate and walked alongside the west side of the White Tower, which would have been on her right. When she reached the top left corner of the White Tower, she would have seen the Chapel of St. Peter ad Vincula in the far left, the place where shortly she would be buried, and to her right, she would have seen a large open expanse with the scaffold at its centre. Despite being classed as a private execution, a crowd of 1,000 people had still gathered to see the first queen in English history die, which mercifully was very quick, consisting of a single strike from the sword by the expert executioner sent from Calais. As Anne Boleyn looked out from the scaffold, taking in her last moments on earth, the imposing White Tower would have been the most vivid representation of the power and might of the great Tudor dynasty, which is perhaps fitting given that it is one of the very few things to survive into the modern era. The loss of the tower's many other buildings, in particular the Great Hall and Royal Apartments, is devastating for fans of history, and if I had the ability to time travel, I think I would go back to the Tudor period and take a look at the tower as it was then, although probably at the time of Anne Boleyn's coronation rather than her execution. And so that brings me to the end of this week's episode of the Tudor Chess Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. In addition to this, my weekly episode, I also release a weekly subscriber-only episode, which you can access via my Patreon account or via Apple Podcasts. On Patreon, in addition to the podcast, I also release a bi-weekly conversation called Historian Unwrapped, in which I speak to some of the most well-known historians working today about their lives as historians. What are their opinions? Who would their dream dinner party guests be, and so on. To sign up to this and get access to all of the Tudor Chess content that I produce, just head to patreon.com/thetudorchest. Thank you again, and speak soon.